Each year at the Levis Prize reading, it's my privilege to evoke the memory of Larry Levis and to invoke his spirit. I'm happy to say that he was both my colleague and my friend. And I know for certain that he was my friend because he was never afraid to borrow money from me. He almost always paid it back. In the early years of this memorial evening, it was at times painful, though cathartic, to tell anecdotes and to call back memories of a remarkable person and a terrific writer who was missed by everyone who knew him. Now, though he is still missed, of course, there is perhaps more joy in this evening as we remember him, since we can take pleasure in seeing that his poetry continues to grow in popularity and influence, especially among young American writers, many of whom never had the opportunity to know him personally. Among the many that might be, there are two things that are guaranteed to be great equalizers: to bring us all into a state of humility and awe, death and stars. Looking at the stars, especially in winter, when our vision of them is sharpest, is necessarily an encounter with mortality and immortality. Making eye contact with light pouring down from a star already dead for a million years, facing the vast mythic lives of the deathless gods, mankind has projected onto the milky, shadowy shapes of the night sky. We are, all of us and each of us, unimportant as we look out at the stars, made aware that we are riding around on a rock, traveling through a wearisome territory so vast, even if we had many hundreds of lifetimes to spend, we could not escape the vicinity of our own galaxy. Inescapably, then, we long ago populated that sky with many godlike figures, and later with the singular figure many among us think of as a father. And for many of us, looking up into the night is a gaze into the coils of the mind of the Almighty, the great Father in the sky. As it was for Larry Levis when I was a small boy attempting to survive the mind-freezing 1950s, all fathers were gods, especially to sons. Like the mythic god in the sky, they were distant, powerful, all-knowing, and mostly silent. They didn't say much at all, those Gary Cooper heroes of the 50s westerns and combat films. The sons of these fathers were expected to say very little back to them as well, their part of an unspoken agreement. The sons were expected to know what the fathers were thinking without ever hearing them say so. The appalling dust and smoke of the Great Depression and the Second World War still hung in the air and choked off the words. Violence, when it occurred, was swift and targeted. Violence still made sense. Or at least that's what our parents believed, and they acted on those beliefs, which were deeply held. In the middle of his life's way, Larry Levis published a collection of poems that is an examination of the coils of his own mind's journey. The book had been composed, he explains in the notes section, from a beginning in Iowa in 1980 to a completion in Bucharest in 1983. The arrangement of the poems in the book is roughly chronological, according to the order of their composition, and thus it provides a particular kind of poetic autobiography. The title poem of the book is Winter Stars, and that title itself accomplishes a great deal in the achievement of meaning in the poem and in the book, suggesting, as I have already begun to suggest, that it is about taking the long view as well as about clear vision, the kind of thinking and looking one performs while gazing at stars in winter, which has something in common with looking at the blank reality of erasure and loss, such as a father's increasing absence of memory, or his painful absence in memory, absences Levis seeks to fight against as poet and as son. The primary setting of Winter Stars is the ranch in the Central Valley of California where Larry Levis grew up. Not a ranch with cattle, but a house with a barn and a few sheds for machinery, a house with a back porch, where one afternoon after his death, I sat with Larry's mother, looking out at the orchards and vineyards that surrounded us. The secondary setting for the poem is a backyard in Columbia, Missouri, from which the narrator looks up at the stars and looks back at his childhood in the vineyards. In an essay titled Mock Mockers After That, the title is a phrase from a poem by William Butler Yeats, Larry Levis wrote, "The elegy always involved another, and the poet working in his elegy toward what he expects to be catharsis and release, sometimes finds them only at the cost of being accused and reprimanded by the being whom he has turned into a figure, into a literary convention, which, by its own definition, has little alternative but to falsify the life and death it preys upon." One way to understand the several implications in that opening phrase of that passage, the elegy always involved another, is to remember that every elegy is also an elegy for the poet writing it. That was especially the case for Levis, and perhaps in a sense all of his poems are elegies for himself, a realization that he emphasized rather pointedly and sometimes sardonically in his last book. The self-interrogation involved in questioning the betrayals to which words almost always lead, and in rooting out the sort of easy affirmations that are in fact lies, was a manner of interior investigation that Levis characteristically applied. And his poem, Winter Stars, is one of those ruthlessly honest yet awestruck quests and questionings that make sense, coldly accurate, yet loving sense, of an encounter with death and stars, fathers and sons. Winter Stars. My father once broke a man's hand over the exhaust pipe of a John Deere tractor. The man, Ruben Vasquez, wanted to kill his own father with a sharpened fruit knife, and he held the curved tip of it lightly between his first two fingers so it could slash horizontally and with surprising grace across a throat. It was like a glinting beak in a hand, and for a moment, the light held still on those vines. When it was over, my father simply went in and ate lunch, and then, as always, lay alone in the dark, listening to music. He never mentioned it. I never understood how anyone could risk his life, then listen to Vivaldi. Sometimes I go out into this yard at night and stare through the wet branches of an oak in winter and realize I am looking at the stars again, a thin haze of them, shining and persisting. It used to make me feel lighter looking up at them. In California, the light was closer. In a California no one will ever see again, my father is beginning to die. Something inside him is slowly taking back every word it ever gave him. Now, if we try to talk, I watch my father search for a lost syllable as if it might solve everything. And though he can't remember now the word for it, he is ashamed. If you can think of the mind as a place continually visited, a whole city placed behind the eyes and shining, I can imagine now its end, as when the lights go off one by one in a hotel at night, until at last all of the travelers will be asleep, or until even the thin glow from the lobby is a kind of sleep. And while the woman behind the desk is applying more lacquer to her nails, you can almost believe that the elevator, as it ascends, must open upon starlight. I stand out in the street and do not go in. That was our agreement at my birth. And for years I believed that what went unsaid between us became empty and pure, like starlight, and that it persisted. I got it all wrong. I wound up believing in words the way a scientist believes in carbon after death. Tonight, I'm talking to you, Father. Although it is quiet here in the Midwest, where a small wind the size of a wrist wakes the cold again, which may be all that's left of you and me. When I left home at 17, I left for good. The pale haze of stars goes on and on, like laughter that has found a final silent shape on a black sky. It means everything it cannot say. Look, it's empty out there and cold. Cold enough to reconcile even a father, even a son.